evening and welcome to episode 84 of the Deck Tease Podcast, brought to you by GatheringMagic.com. My name is Aaron Campbell. My guest tonight is very special. He is a level 5 judge, and he's affectionately known as the godfather of EDH. He is Sheldon Mennery. Hello.
Thanks for having me on. I think we're going to have a good time.
Yeah, I think so, too. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Sure.
Now, I have to be honest with you, Sheldon. I'm a little intimidated by you.
It's certainly not the first time somebody's said that. And you know, I hope that I hope that both in my personal life and in my judging career that the sort of intensity that I bring to things isn't off-putting like you said, intimidating. I'd like to believe that I'm a pretty open person and anybody can come up and talk to me. I gained a reputation a long time ago for scaring the bad guys. The people who wanted the cheated Magic tournaments, I wanted them to be afraid of me, and they should still be afraid of me, even though I'm 2 years retired.
That's fantastic. I actually found you intimidating. I've never had the joy of meeting you, although I would certainly like to, but I always do extensive research on my guests. And when I went to Google and when I looked around to find out things about you, Sheldon, in all of your pictures, you seem to have this trademark glare.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't want to mess with him. And it was very hard to find pictures of you smiling or not in that mode.
Well, I think that came about a long time ago. Pro Tour photographer Craig Gibson was shooting at a World Championships in Japan, so probably 2005 or so. And he's like, look mean. And I said, sure. So, you know, we got the infamous crossed arms scowl photo that was sort of my icon for a long time, and you know, I just continued that. And again, it's that glare of disapproval isn't for the good guys; that's for the bad guys.
Nice. The other reason I'm a little intimidated by you, Sheldon, is I have a very love-hate relationship with judges. I love them in the sense that I like to flirt with some of them. there's a number that I find adorable. I think the uniform is great. I admit I have a weakness for a cute judge. I'm sorry about that. Where the hate comes from is I have a bit of a tilting issue, and there have been some unfortunate incidents between me and judges that I'm not very proud of, and I'm convinced that there's like a judge's headquarters somewhere, and there's a file cabinet with all the offenders, and I'm pretty sure there's like a folder about an inch thick with me and all of my shenanigans. So I was very surprised, and part of me was going, oh God, he's going to know who I am and what I said at Gen Con, and I that one inappropriate comment, and oh God, and I was very worried.
Well, you know, I was in charge of the DCI Investigations Committee for quite a long time, so
oh yeah,
you know, I can't discuss any ongoing investigations.
Well, it's not that bad, but I mean, I definitely was a little naughty back in the day. And even now, it's like if I see a cute judge, I know I was at a GP Richmond, and there was a gentleman named Guillaume who was a judge from France, and a couple of my girlfriends and I were like, hey, Guillaume, read these in French to us. He was a really good sport about it, and like I said, I love them, but at the same time, I've also had some run-ins, so.
Well, I think the primary message is, for the most part, judges are there to help you, not to hurt you.
Yes. Absolutely.
And I think it was Colin Jackson who said it. You know, somebody asked him, well, when he was DQing somebody for cheating, and somebody said, well, you know, you kicking me out of this tournament is not good customer service. And his response was, yes, it is. It's good customer service to everybody else in the DCI.
Mm. That's definitely a good way to put it. So let's go ahead and talk about how you got here, Sheldon. So normally I ask the people on my show how they got started playing Magic. I kind of want to know more about how you got started being a judge. And tell me about the time before you were level one where you decided you wanted to do this.
Well, in the first part, I was never a level one. But we can get to that.
Sure.
So you know, I've been a lifelong gamer.
Okay.
And I was reasonably heavily involved with the RPGA in the 80s, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. So my first trips to Gen Con were all about running RPGs and doing all that. I was actually at Gen Con 1993 when the game debuted. And I picked up a starter and a booster from the Wizards of the Coast booth. Mm-hmm. And I was there with my ex-wife and two friends of ours. And, you know, it was like, oh, what's this this kind of cool thing? I'm like, oh, it's a card game that'll never last. And we got a starter and a booster and walked away. And Gen Con was divided up into slots back in those days. There were four-hour blocks. I don't even remember if they were called blocks or slots or whatever. And there were 13 of them for the weekend. And I think I ran D&D modules, like 10 out of the 13 of them. So I had one slot available to go to the dealer room and try to take it all in. And that's where I grabbed that starter and that booster of Magic, because it just kind of looked, you know, everybody was making a fuss over it, and the game was like they were playing a game and they were having fun. And, you know, the best advertisement for a game is other people having fun playing it.
Sure.
We bought the stuff, and then I went back to running games, seeing the dealer's room, and then running games for the rest of the weekend. So it wasn't till our friends were playing in the back of the car on the drive from Milwaukee back to D.C. that I actually ever saw the game played in person. And it wasn't maybe till a month later that I actually played for the first time myself, and the first game I played in, I was absolutely hooked. I think mm-hmm. Veteran Bodyguard was the card that got me hooked. You know, back then we were wondering how you could lose when you had Prodigal Sorcerer in play, because like, you know, it's a 20 turn clock and you're dead.
Yeah.
So. So that was 93. In early 94, I was stationed at the Pentagon, and I got reassigned to the NATO Programming Center in Belgium. So I took my Magic cards with me when I went to Belgium, found a couple other Magic players in the local community. The NATO Programming Center was a multinational unit, so there were Germans and Dutch and Danish and Norwegians mm-hmm. and everything. So I got involved with some of the other folks there who were also gamers, and then ran a few local tournaments, got involved with a local store or two, and then decided to go to the first Grand Prix ever in Amsterdam in 1996. My memory of those days is a little fuzzy, but I think it was 1996.
Sure.
I played day one and went 3-2-1, which of course wasn't good enough to get to day two. So I was wandering around the hall on day two looking for something to do. And this guy at the Wizards of the Coast booth was like, "Hey, you, do you know the rules of Magic?" And I said, "Yeah, I actually know the rules of Magic reasonably well." He said, "Would you like to be a judge?" And I said, I don't know. What does a judge do?" As well as a tournament official, runs events and sanctioned tournaments and stuff. I said, "Well, I'm already doing that, so sure." And back then, your score on the test determined the level that you started at.
Really?
Yep. So I scored high enough to make level 2. You could make one level 1, 2, or 3 that way. So I scored high enough to make level 2 from the beginning. Then I judged my first pro tour in Mainz, Germany in 97. And by that time, I, you know, had gotten involved with one of the bigger stores in Belgium and were, you know, I was running PTQs and, you know, their high-level events, their pre-releases and whatnot. Because back in the day, remember, pre-releases were
big.
Were huge. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, we'd run these 700-person pre-releases with a staff of 8 people or something, and, you know, it was insane. I went to my first Pro Tour Mainz in 97, and some of the higher-level folks in the judge program, Carl Crook, Misha Donders, we're like, you know, we've heard a lot about you. We should test you for level 3. I was like, sure. Now, I always said back in the day that the level 3 test should be the most difficult thing you do at level 3. It sort of prepares you for what you're gonna face, and all the rigors that I put other judges through in interviewing them for level 3 aren't compared to what I went through. I interviewed for level 3 at midnight at the end of the first day that I ever judged a Pro Tour. So I'd been on the floor from 8 a.m. to midnight. And then went into my interview, and Carl and Misha and another fine Belgian judge named Ken Bontnick stood me on my head for about 2 hours, demonstrated what I didn't know about judging magic, and sent me on my way.
Wow.
A year later, actually less than a year later, at Grand Prix Antwerp, I interviewed once again for level 3 and made it. That day, I think that was a big day for both the European judge program and the judge program as a whole, because three of us, myself, Jaap Brouwer, Gijs Hoogendyk, all made level 3 at that event.
Nice.
So that, you know, it was sort of one of those days, those formative days that you can point back to in the history of the judge program. Mm-hmm. So that was level 3. So I started doing bigger and bigger events, European championships. And when I came back to the States in 2000, well, actually, I did my first domestic Pro Tour, Chicago, in 99. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to the States in 2000, to Alaska, which was, you know, travel to Pro Tours from there was awful. But hey, you know, it had to be done.
Yeah.
And then after Worlds in San Francisco 2004, we realized that there was this sort of expansion of the judge program necessary. You know, more events, bigger events. The program needed more people at higher levels of responsibility. And when did I make level 4? I made level 4 before that, I think. Again, these seemed like ancient times. And we were, quite honestly, the judge program today is brilliant. There's a training program. There are lots of really smart people like Toby Elliott and Kevin Dupre and Scott Marshall and the current level 5s who are really taking care of the judges. Back, 10 years ago, we were making it up as we went along. We were definitely there, trying to drain the swamp and having to pay attention to the alligators. So we really had to sort of invent the judge program as we were performing in the judge program. So I had made level 4 before Worlds San Francisco. I think I made it in San Diego that year. And with the sort of new world order of the post-World San Francisco judge program, where in the earlier days there was only one level 5, we realized that Andy Hecht and the great minds at Wizards of the Coast who were running the judge program realized that an expansion was in order. Mm-hmm. So the folks who had already, the level 4s who had already head judged Pro Tours, Geese, Mike Guptill, Rune Horvick, would be promoted to level 5, and Jaap and I, who had yet to head judge our first Pro Tour, would wait until we did head judge our Pro Tour, and then be promoted. So I was promoted in 2005, Pro Tour Atlanta. So there was never, for me, there was never really a, an N plus one syndrome. There's, you get a lot of people, judges are really highly motivated, self-identifying performers. Mm-hmm. And one of the downsides of that is that is what we call N plus one syndrome, that people see on a higher level, and again, being high performing people, they strive to achieve it. Mm-hmm. And that of course creates a problem, because there are more great judges in the program than there are spots for them at the higher level.
And that's something that's actually come up before. I've had the pleasure of having, I've had Ricky Hayashi on my show, I had Kim Warren on my show, and they both sort of alluded to the fact that, not that the ambition was frowned upon necessarily, but the fact that while you may want to be a higher level judge, there has to be a need for that, and that ultimately, like you said, the players come first, right. And that, you know, if there's not enough room for that many level fours, or we don't need that many, that does have to sort of wait. And then there was talk about having to sort of stifle that a little bit, where you can't be too ambitious or you can't be too driven, because you can't just make a spot for you in
right.
that circle.
Like, right. Leadership in any organization follows the necessities of the organization. And while there are brilliant level three judges, if there's not a spot to promote them into at level four, because some time ago, I started working on the philosophy of what I called at the time pillars and spheres. Mm-hmm. And each level four would have a sphere of responsibility, tournament logistics, judge training, these kind of things, rules, knowledge. And then the level fives were responsible for the pillars, which several different spheres stood. The name pillars and spheres, I don't think, continued forward very far, because it seemed an awkward analogy. Mm-hmm. But the idea of areas of responsibility for the fours and areas of responsibility for the five, you know, sort of higher, you know, bigger picture areas of responsibility for the fives, I believe has lasted through until these days. So if fours aren't necessarily better judges than threes, back in the old days, a level was kind of just a recognition of a level of both rules knowledge and expertise, then tournament expertise. The early high level judges were all rules gurus. And that, you know, that isn't the only quality that we needed from high level judges. We needed tournament experience. We needed leadership ability.
Sure.
So there are people who are perfectly qualified to be four and five, but there's got to be room for them. And I think we decided a long, long time ago that judge levels weren't just honorifics. They were recognition of a responsibility. So, you know, at three, you sort of have this regional responsibility, and it doesn't necessarily translate in scope to level four. Because from three to four, you go to this sort of continental level of responsibility and programmatic level of responsibility, which doesn't translate to any geographic region. So it's not a straight line up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right. Now, you said something a little earlier I want to touch on. You mentioned the fact that judges tend to be very motivated people.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it that motivated you, that made you want to strive for something more? Because I have several friends who are judges, and there are some that are level twos, and they're very happy being
mm-hmm.
level twos, and they're very comfortable with that. And then there are the ones that want more for themselves. So what was it about the program that made you want to keep going?
Well, again, there wasn't the same sort of objective, clear path when I was coming up, and the judge program needed leaders in the truest sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe, trying to look back on it objectively, I really believe that I got promoted up through the levels because the because I was the guy that the program needed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about so much about doing something to earn my own recognition, but I'm a really big believer, Aaron, in responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk in America especially a lot about our rights, but those rights are balanced with responsibilities, and I believe in giving back to the community and providing what my skill set happened to be good in, leadership, to an organization, was my sort of giving back to the mm-hmm. community.
It's definitely a good answer, and that's something I don't hear very much. Like I said, a lot of times, you know, and to be honest, I don't think I've ever really asked people, you know, like Kim Warren has got promoted to level 4. I never really asked her why, and I've always been curious, and I'm curious how many people feel the same way as you, that they're giving back, you know. I've heard some people say, you know, I'm not very good at this game, and that's why I became a judge, but I would love to know, you know, how many people are really doing it for that sort of selfless aspect.
No, I actually think... First of all, I believe that the average judge is a better Magic player than the average non-judge.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I don't believe that the average judge is a better Magic player than people who frequently make day two at the GP. But as far as Magic players in general, I think judges are probably better players. I'm not gonna suggest that there are 24 judges that could go play on the Pro Tour, but there are certainly high level judges who have. Rashad Miller played on the Pro Tour. Kevin Dupre played on the Pro Tour, and he's a level 5 now. It's not out of the realm of possibilities that judges are great Magic players. Now that being said, being a high level competitive Magic player is an investment is a time investment. And it's a particular kind of time investment. It's a sort of regular, ongoing, continual time investment. Whereas in judging, you can sort of pick your spots to do your investments. I don't think the investment is any less significant, but mm-hmm. the sort of temporal sense of it is different. So judges can be a little more selective about the whens of getting involved. I do believe that there are people who are like, you know, I love competitive Magic, but I'm not going to be that good. But here's the thing that I am good at, so I am going to give back to the community. I believe you will find a significant level of idealism in the judge community about the whys and the whats of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are one of the leaders of the judges program, and it seems like there's a lot of layers to it. So walk me through the different parts and what each section is sort of responsible for. You touched on that a little bit with the pillars and the spheres.
Uh-huh. Well, honestly, I don't know anymore. There are these sort of meta responsibilities for judges of the higher level. But quite honestly, I'm not sure I could delineate right now exactly what a level 3 judge is responsible for. I know that a level 3 judge is responsible for leadership in an area, a certain high level of rules knowledge and term and organization knowledge, but it would be difficult for me these now almost 2.5 years removed to speak with any specificity on the nuts and bolts of what the judges are responsible for. Again, at the highest levels, it's programmatic things, and at the mid levels, it's about people and player things. So the 4s and 5s are the people that sort of administer the wither 2s and the y 4s of the program itself, plus also have a responsibility to events. You know, the level 5s are the guys head judging Pro Tours, and the 3s have a narrower focus on their geographic regions, and the 2s maybe even a smaller focus on their smaller geographic regions, and then the ones on a store or two in their neighborhood.
It's interesting that you would say that to imply that things had changed that much in 2 years. I didn't think that would be the case.
Well, I don't know if they've changed that much in 2 years. It's that I don't, like I said, I don't know about the specifics of the program that much anymore.
Sure.
I mean, I keep tabs on a bunch of the people that I know. What I will tell you about the program today versus the program of yesteryear is that the program today is focused on putting judges where people play Magic. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, we were focused top down. So everything in the judge program focused on the Pro Tour and then what that meant in trickle down to the rest of the program, to other places that people were playing Magic. And at a certain point, we realized that, you know, at the Pro Tour, we're only talking about 300 or 400 players. And in the wild, we're talking about millions of players. So there was a shift in the focus of the program to go bottom up. So expend the resources of the program where more people are playing Magic. So this is where we saw the rapid expansion of the judge program into 2,000, 2,500, 3,000, 4,000 judges worldwide, because we wanted more boots on the ground, as it were, to help people in their Magic life with both casual and competitive events.
Mm-hmm.
So the focus was significant because it changed how you trained people. You don't train people today necessarily so that they can get to the Pro Tour. You train them so that they can get to the GP. You train them so that they have the tools that they need for their region. And then the Pro Tour is a very small event now. I think we've done them with 21 or 22 judges since the privatization of the Pro Tour. And the goals of the program are to make judges capable and qualified for the events that they're going to judge regularly. So, that's why there's a certain level of training that goes into a level one, a slightly higher level of training that goes into a two and to a three. Because of the types of events that they're going to judge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about that a little bit because there's been a lot of talk recently about changes to organized play, and specifically with judges, because as I'm sure you're aware, there's been a rise in attendance at major events. You know, GPs are having record attendance.
Sure.
We just don't have small events anymore. And there's been some talk about, you know, there was a time where you could put a whole bunch of level ones at a GP and they could get this great learning experience. But now there's talk of the fact that GPs are so big now that you may need more level twos instead of level ones, and that may not be the place to sort of have them cut their teeth.
Exactly. It's not. Mm-hmm. The place for level ones to cut their teeth is under the guidance of a level two in their local area. And
so you agree with those changes?
Absolutely.
Then, or that the talk?
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
The level one judge is designed, you know, the judges of different levels are designed for different events. Your ones are for your store events, your twos are for your PTQs, and your threes are to lead those PTQs and judge at your GPs. And it's not an assignation of someone's value, it's an assignation of someone's experience level mm-hmm. and knowledge level. There are wonderful people that are level ones and level two judges. They just need some more seasoning in order to get to those larger events. Of course, there's a point where you're going to need to bring a level one to your PTQ, or you're going to need to bring a level one perhaps to your smaller GP because they need to get the experience. You can't say, well, we don't want you because you don't have the experience, and then never give them the opportunity to get the experience.
Right.
But yeah, absolutely, I absolutely agree with the way that the judge program is currently staffing their events.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other changes that you could think of if you had to suggest them for where the program can go from here based on this boom in attendance?
Yeah, they could bring me back into the program as level 6 and pay me $225,000 a year to run the whole show. I think that would be the most awesome result of any changes.
Would they carry you on, like, would there, like, you know how Cleopatra had that platform? Would there be, like, 4 level ones carrying you into the venue?
Yeah, no. I think maybe, you know, maybe clearing the way, but I don't need the sedan chair. I'm not so old that I can't walk in myself.
Maybe it could be a version of, like, the Pope Mobile, you know?
I imagine I might need the bulletproof glass, given my history with a few players.
Well, it's nice to hear that you know, you're still sort of keeping tabs on things, that you agree with where things are going.
Yeah.
That's definitely a good thing.
Yeah, I still pay attention. I'm not up to my elbows in it anymore, but mm-hmm. I still have great friends in the judge program. Less than a month ago, DCI tournament manager Scott Larrabee and level 5 judge Toby Elliott visited me here in Florida for a week.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, we did a lot of gaming and eating and drinking and debauchery. I'm still involved with people in the judge program.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned, you know, that you're not necessarily with the program anymore and you decided to retire in 2011. What prompted that decision?
Well, a couple of things. I think the major one was that I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. I think that I had done a lot of great work on behalf of the judge program, but I wasn't necessarily sure that there was more great work for me to do. I believed that the transition in the program meant that my sort of fire and brimstone style of leadership wasn't required anymore. You know, it takes different skill set to conquer a kingdom than it does to rule a kingdom. I think I'm more of the conquest style than the ruler style. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, I think that there wasn't more, there just wasn't any place else for me to go with the program. Mm-hmm. And I felt as though that other leadership styles, there were great people behind me that deserved promotion, and like we talked earlier, there was no, when there's no spot for them, you can't promote them. So at the end of 2011, with my final event was Worlds in San Francisco, I thought it was the right time to step aside. And one of the reasons that I felt as though it was right to step aside was because there was a great judge, Jason LeMahieu, who was going to step in and take my place.
He's from my state.
I would have been less likely to retire when I did if there wasn't a LEMS coming in behind me.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say retired, how firm is that? Like, you could never do it again? Or, like, could you jump back in if you wanted to?
I could jump back in if I wanted to. I'm sure that I could jump back in if I wanted to.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Again, I could jump back in, but I would almost not necessarily see the value to the program of me jumping in.
Well, sure.
You know, there's what worlds are there to conquer anymore mm-hmm. for us? You know, the program today is about doing more of what the program does better, as opposed to creating new horizons for the program. In 2012, in January 2012, I started doing Pro Tour coverage, and it was a great opportunity to step into a new role, and there was no way that I was going to be able to do both. There was no way that I was going to be able to judge at that level, because being a level 5 judge, I'm going to tell you, is a huge time investment. There was no way that I was going to be able to be a level 5 judge and be a Pro Tour coverage personality at the same time. It was about a half an hour from the time that middle of the year, maybe May or so of 2011, Scott Larrabee was visiting, and we were sitting one night drinking a bottle of wine and having a discussion, and we talked about the possibility of me retiring, and about half an hour later, I got a message from Greg Collins, who runs the Pro Tour coverage team, saying, if you're going to retire, we'd like you to come join the team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a new door opened as I was thinking about closing an old one. So jumping into that was a great opportunity. And, that was one of the major reasons that I felt as though it was a good time to move along.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss it? Do you miss judging?
Yes and no. There are certainly people I miss. There are judges in the program that are just great human beings, and I miss hanging around with them. There are people associated with the Pro Tour that I absolutely love, from from BDM and Marshall Sutcliffe to folks like Deb Slater, who is in the production team behind, to Greg Collins and to the Pro Tour players. I mean, one of the things that I believe as a strong part of my legacy was establishing great relationships with Pro Tour players. And there's a lot of those guys I miss. I miss Bram Snetbongers bringing me Strupp waffles at the Pro Tour. And I miss the people. Do I miss long trips to exotic locations? Not really. I said recently the worst thing about having status on an airline is earning status on an airline. and I'm not a young man anymore, and I don't travel as well as I used to. So there are certainly things that I miss. I love the pageantry of the GP and the sort of smell of smoke and grease paint at the Pro Tour. But the traveling to and from and the long days, I can't honestly say that I miss that.
Mm-hmm. Now, not only are you famous for being a respected high-level judge, you also literally made your own format, EDH.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make a format?
Well, not easily.
Is there like a process or paperwork?
There's paperwork in triplicate. So EDH, I didn't invent the basic mechanics of EDH. I got those from my gaming group in Alaska, and the guy who came up with its name is Adam Staley, and we had a really, really good gaming group, and we played games of all kinds. We played RPGs, we played board games, we painted miniatures, we watched nerd movies. You know, we were the sort of the quintessence of the adult professional gamer group. Mm-hmm. We met at the house of one of our members, David Pfeiffer, every Monday for something, whether it was playing Hot Shots Golf on this new fangled thing called the PS2, playing Risk 2212 or whatever, whatever it was called.
Sure.
And we were also Magic players. We had a really good Friday Night Magic scene, and I was the tournament organizer up there when I was in Alaska. And one day I showed up at David's house, and they were like, "Oh, you got this new format that Staley invented called EDH." It's like, what's EDH? And it's like, Elder Dragon Highlander. Okay, so all of us have one of the Elder Dragons, So they explained the basics, and the mechanics were quite rudimentary. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay. And they were having fun, so I kind of paid attention, and we talked about it a fair amount, but it never actually got around to playing while I was in Alaska. We talked about expanding it to beyond the generals being the five Elder Dragons, because more of us wanted to play, and I looked at the rule set. I was the only one of us that had any significant tournament administration or rule set administration experience. And I was like, well, there's some things here that aren't going to work. If we want to do this, there are certain cards that don't make any sense, and there are certain rules that don't make any sense. Let me work with this a little bit. So we talked about it in theory a fair amount, and I left Alaska in March of 2003 for my next assignment at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. And I kind of took the format with me, and I formed a new gaming group, like, you know, all of us do when we move to a new place. And the guys that I played with were these great guys that were very casual Magic players. I mean, they were the absolute avatars of the kitchen table Magic players. They had these small, you know, some very small collections. You know, they weren't buying boxes and cases and stuff. They were buying booster packs every now and again. We played a fair amount of multiplayer games. And one day, so like, there's this format that I brought with me from Alaska. You want to give it a whirl? And I explained the basics of it, and they're like, yeah, that sounds like fun. And within the span of 2 months, it was all anybody ever wanted to play. So somebody on the Pro Tour asked me what I've been doing lately. I said, well, we've been playing a lot of this EDH. I'm like, well, you know, let's give it a whirl. And I'd written a Star City article on it sometime in early 2004, I think, because it was just cool. You know, it's just like, here's a cool idea. Sure. So basically, you know, I brought it to the judges on the Pro Tour, because we were, you know, kind of looking for something to do. Not everybody likes drafting so much, or people wanted an alternative to drafting. So, you know, they like, oh, let's try this. And it just caught on like the proverbial wildfire. The judges loved it. It was intricate. It was different. It had, you know, this social level to it, this multiplayer ethic to it, and players glommed onto it. Judges glommed onto it relatively quickly. Occasionally, players would come by, hey, you guys are having a good time. What are you doing? So we'd tell them what we were doing. And one day at Pro Tour Atlanta, and I think it might have been that Pro Tour that I made level 5, Scott was looking for me and found me playing EDH. He's like, come on, let's go to dinner. I was like, no, we're about to play some EDH. And it was me and Geese and, you know, some of the other high-level guys. And he's like, mm-hmm. Well, okay, give me a deck and I'll play. And I had brought 3 or 4 with me, and I handed him my Lord of Tressorhorn deck. As a matter of fact, I handed him the deck that won the contest on Star City that I had posted for. It's basically, here's the format, build a good Lord of Tressorhorn deck. Yeah. And I handed Scott the deck that won. He's about 6 turns in. He's like, this is the best format ever. Scott's really the one that was responsible for taking it back to Wizards of the Coast. And just like in the judge program, the match was lit, and it spread through WotC, and kind of here we are.
Mm-hmm. So break down, I mean, the finer points of it. Like, I mean, like you see, you indicated there was a lot of paperwork. So, I mean, did you have to go through, like, legal? Like, how does this, you know what I mean? Like, what was the fine print of all
that? No, I was being glib when I said that.
No,
one day they came to me and said, hey, by the way, we want to make this an online format. You know, we want to code this for online. Lee Sharp and Michael Elf-Fuel had a lot to do with that, being WotC programmers and fans of the format. We want to do this, but there are some things we have to think about. And Elder Dragon Highlander as the name was one of them, because of the Highlander intellectual property, whoever owns that. You know, whether it's Columbia Pictures or whoever, there may be an IP challenge to that. So we just want to head that off at the pass. What do you think about the name Commander? And you know, I was like, yeah, sure, seems okay. You know, I get the legal necessities of living in the commercial world. So sure. It became modestly popular online, and then, you know, a couple years back, Scott pinged me one day and said, "Hey, I got to talk to you about something." Look at that. He said, "We're gonna start making a product for Commander." Like, best thing ever.
That must have felt pretty good.
Yeah, sure it does. I mean, it feels great to have some responsibility in bringing a lot of fun to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Were there any challenges in getting this off the ground?
No, I didn't. Well, not for me, there weren't.
Okay.
I got to sort of reap the benefits of the business without doing any of the business work for it. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of, there's a lot of social benefits for me from the format, and, you know, certainly not giant fiscal ones, but, the folks, the great folks in R&D at Wizards of the Coast did the work. Mm-hmm. The folks in the brand and marketing folks, those were the people that did all the work. For me, it was just, watch it all unfold.
Mm-hmm. Are you happy with where EDH is at right now?
Quite happy, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of people that sort of get what we're laying down for the format. Mm-hmm. We have a philosophy, and it's sort of clearly spelled out in our philosophy document. And one of the the short version of that sort of is, we don't want it to be alt vintage. We don't want it to be just another Magic format with a different rule or two. You know, we want it to have a different feel. It really was, created as a format mm-hmm. for a social crowd. It was mm-hmm. it's intended to be social Magic. If some players want to play it sort of non-socially, I think that's fine, as long as everybody in the game is agreeing that that's the kind of game they're going to play. Mm-hmm. But the folks, the fan base, the real broad fan base of the format, have glommed onto the social aspect of the format. And that's, one of the big things that draws them there. It's the sort of big, splashy, epic, very Timmy-esque things happen in the format. And by the way, there's a lot of laughs along the way. I mean, Commander is beer and pretzels Magic.
Yeah.
And it's going to stay that way. We are going to resist any urge, not that anybody on the rules committee has any urges to make it a competitive format. As a matter of fact, it would be the worst thing ever to happen to it.
It's interesting that you say that, because I received a number of questions from people who are very big Commander fans, and I understand you're on the rules committee. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay. And I don't know if you can necessarily answer this, because I don't know what goes on behind the scenes or, you know, whatever, but I was told to ask you, I have several friends who were upset about the recent decision to ban Sylvan Caryatid or Sylvan Primordial.
Well,
and
friends,
they were like, why?
Your friends can get over it. That card was toxic to the format.
Really? And it's funny, because they also brought up our Primeval Titan, and they're like, why all the big green creatures? Like, why is this happening?
Yeah. Primeval Titan was toxic to the format. Mm-hmm. Primeval Titan, Sylvan Primordial, just created miserable games. That's why people say, well, what's the power level algorithm that you ban cards for the format in? The cards aren't banned for power level. Cards are banned for what they do to the format. Okay. Cards are banned for interacting poorly with the format, like Worldfire. Worldfire is awful. You know, Worldfire in normal Magic is awful. It's even more awful when you have the command zone. So cards get banned when they create miserable game states. And Sylvan Primordial just created miserable game states when it came out early, and green is in the color to make it come out early. So it was just a card that people love to play it because it was really good and it won them a lot of games, but the heartstrings of Commander are not just you having a good time. It's everybody that you're playing with having a good time.
See, I went through a similar situation with that when my local game store likes to do a Commander game after FNM.
Mm-hmm.
And I had participated for the first time. I was playing an Omnath deck that my friend Brandon Issa built for me. And I went into it thinking it was going to be like that. And I remember I was playing against somebody. We were in a group of four. And he was playing a Goblin deck of sorts. And about five turns in, I want to say, he has, like, Goblin Surgeon, Goblin, some sort of crafter.
Mm-hmm.
And he does this, like, he basically says it's an infinite combo. Yeah. And he's like, well, I won the game. And I'm like, but it's been five turns. Like, I haven't even done anything.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, you can just pack it up. And I was really kind of bothered by that. And I was like, I thought this was going to be, like, I didn't think that was the plan. Like, I thought this was sort of, like you said, the format where you could live the dream and just be like, wee!
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you could do stuff. And I was a little upset about that, and I was surprised because it seemed like I was the only one who was upset about it. And everybody else was like, oh, Aaron, that's just Commander. And I was like, I didn't think that's what it was about.
Yeah.
And
There are plenty of things that happen on turn 15 that are fine, that aren't fine when they happen on turn 5.
Yeah.
You know, we want games to be able to unfold a little bit. And Primeval Titan and Sylvan Primordial were two cards that both really sped the clock up.
Mm-hmm.
And we would rather things play out a little slower than that. So... Mm-hmm. The cards like that that are just too much mana too fast bond, Metal Worker, Talarian Academy, they're bad for the format because they get you to a position where other people aren't playing the game, and we want everybody to have the opportunity to play the game.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, though, I mean, would you say that it would be justified maybe for somebody like me to be a little upset in that situation? Like, you know, what were you doing? Infinite comboing?
Well,
and turn five?
Not,
you know?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I think it behooves you to find out the kind of game. If you're the outsider coming into a game, I think it behooves you to find out what kind of game it is.
Right.
There's a particular kind of game that we promote and that we support on the Rules Committee.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that other styles aren't valid,
okay.
But our primary message is that the people in the group have to agree on the sort of style of game. In the baseline, we'd like to think that all Commander games, unless otherwise agreed upon, are going to be the social style. But I don't see anything wrong with four people who are of the let's see who can combo out fastest mindset get together and play. The problem is when you cross the streams and you get the, you know, the two players at the table who are combo, 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 combo turn three, and two other players are like, I had hoped to play a game for 90 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So it's finding your group, and whether that's in the online community or in your local game shop or kitchen table, it's about finding your community. So I think you had a little justification to be upset because the group sort of went off what we think the baseline is, but at the same time, they're used to this is the style of game that they want, so. They think that it's up to the outsider to figure out or ask what kind of game it is.
Well, I think another reason I was so upset was because I was under the impression, because like I said, the deck that was built for me, I didn't build the deck. I admit that, you know, Brandon built it for me, and I basically gave him a budget restraint, and I built the deck. And I think the whole deck cost no more than like $60.
Uh-huh.
And I was really nervous to even participate, because I was like, guys, I'm going to be so bad at this, and oh, I don't have a lot of good cards. And they were like, it's okay. And, you know, they had sort of lulled me into the sense of feeling like it would be a casual game, and it was okay if my janky Omnath deck, you know, showed up, and I was like, okay, here goes, you know, and, you know, I was made to feel like it was going to be that fun game. We're not keeping score. We're just here to have fun. And then, and here I am laying out my little forest, and I'm thinking of all the ways I'm going to spend this awesome mana, and then I'm dead. And I was like, you know, had they told me, you know, or had I had the feeling it was going to be like that, I certainly wouldn't have even participated, because I would have known it was going to be like that. But if the, you know, when they're telling me, it's okay if you're bad, it's okay if you're new, and then, you know, here I come and I'm completely whomped, I did feel a little deceived there.
Well, you gotta, I think you have to use your skills at judging people when you ask people questions like that. You know, we call those untrusted games. They're games with people that you don't know. And, you know,
well, I've been playing FNM at the store for years, so.
So you should know the people.
I should.
You know, when somebody reveals their general, now, you know, if I had sat down at the table with you and you were playing Omnath, I would keep my eye on you, because you could kill me with, you know, commander damage pretty fast. Actually, one of my best stories is when I first started hanging around Armada Games. Jeez, it's been 5 years, 6 years, 7 years now. And it was the first time one of the regulars, whose name is Apple, was playing, and he's playing an Omnath deck. And I was playing my Ruhan You Did It To Yourself deck. And he's got Omnath, and it's like 49-49. And nobody has any blockers. And he's like, I don't want to attack. I don't want to kill somebody this early. And I said, you ain't got the grapes. So he's like, okay, I guess I'll attack you with my 49-49 Omnath. And I noticed, you know, the reason I was goading him on was because I saw that he didn't have any sac outlets on board. So he attacked me with his 49-49 Omnath. I played Mirror Strike and said, Apple, you did this to yourself.
That is vicious. Vicious.
But, you know, I want Commander games to be games where many laughs are had. And I don't care. I don't care if I'm on the losing end of it. You know, if somebody does something absolutely epic and kills me, I'm fine with that. You know, I got killed. Somebody asked me recently what the coolest thing I think I ever lost to was, and it was not so long ago, it was probably 2 years ago or so now, one of the other regulars at Armada, Anthony, played a Riku deck, and Anthony gets the format, and the secret of the, I'm going to tell you what the secret of the format is, and I hope your listeners are going to really pay attention to this part. The secret of Commander is in not breaking it. Mm-hmm. The secret to every other Magic format is finding the angle, is breaking it as badly as you can. And the secret of Commander is exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. So Anthony's playing his reasonably fair Riku deck. And speaking of fair decks, tomorrow on Star City, my article is building a fair Rafik deck, which there aren't too many of out there.
I was going to say, I'm like, how is that going to work?
Tune in to StarCityGames.com tomorrow and find out. So Anthony attacks me with Riku, who is a 2-2, and some other guy, a Siddick Slime or something. And I'm like, okay, no blocks. And he says, okay, I'll cast Mercadia's Downfall on Riku.
Oh, no.
And copy it. Dome you for 23 commander damage. Okay, I lose.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah. Like I said, I want laughs to be had.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned that you write for Star City Games. You also have a blog about food and wine. You are a foodie, Sheldon Menard.
I am indeed.
Interesting. Have your interests in food and magic ever collided or overlapped?
Well, traveling to exotic locations for Pro Tours and GPs has certainly given me the opportunity to eat in some of the world's great restaurants, for sure. There were a few of us foodies at the higher level. Brian David Marshall is a huge foodie. Scott and Toby that I previously mentioned are big foodies. Hélène Bergeau is a big foodie. So there are a number of us, that travel to events and the appreciation of life's finer things hasn't collided so much as coincided. Many opportunities have been there for great meals with great people, in great locations.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you like to cook as well. So if you were to put together a magic-themed meal for me, what would you make me, Sheldon Menery?
That's a really tough question. I've been kind of thinking about it. Here's the thing. So when I started thinking about that question, I looked at Gatherer with all the cards named that have feast in their name. And most of the cards that have feast in their name are black.
I'm a black mage.
There's like Feast of the Unicorn, which is serving a unicorn's head on a platter. And just like, they're all the feasters are all zombies that are eating people's brains. And I'm like, oh, this does not sound like a good meal at all. So I think the answer to the magic-themed meal is one that's going to be left unanswered for now. I'm going to do some thinking on it, and maybe we'll turn it into an article sometime soon.
Oh, that would be fantastic. But I am a black mage, though. Like, you really don't understand. I am such a black mage. Like, when Mark Rosewater did his Drive to Work podcast, he did a series about all the colors of the pie. Mm-hmm. And his episode about being a black mage, I felt like he was talking about me. Like, I was listening to it at work, and I felt like I was in church. Like, you know, you see that lady with the paper fan that just sits there and goes, that was me. Yeah. Like, the whole thing, he was talking about, like, how black responds to things, how black looks at the world, and I was like, he's talking about me. I've never felt so connected to a color as I did when he described it. So I really am a black mage. I really would be fine with unicorns. I'm totally fine with brains. I'm okay with that, so.
Well, black is half of the only true guild, which is Orzhov, so.
Hey. I'm actually a Golgari girl at heart.
Not a real deal.
I have to say, though, I was playing Orzhov when Golgari, because I was playing standard rock pre-rotation. So it was Mutilate, Gerard's Messenger, Droth's Messenger, Thragtusk. But when rotation happened and Golgari wasn't strong enough to play, I did fall back on Orzhov. So I love Orzhov. I love the lore of the guild.
I love the
Vorthos side of it. Yeah. I'll give you that. I love Obsidot. It's so much fun. But I have this weird thing where I can't put Obsidot and Blood Baron in the same deck. I feel like that's really greedy. So I'll see people put them both in the main deck, and I'm like, that's just not – no. But I do love the guild very much. So I'll give you that. But when Golgari has the tools, I'm very much part of the swarm. So I'm just throwing that out there. So last but not least, you know, you're a blogger, you're a foodie, all this stuff. You're also in school. You're studying creative writing, and you're part of an RPG that has been going since 1987. How do you juggle all of these things?
Well, the short answer to that is I'm fortunate in life. I retired in 2004 at the tender age of 43 from the workforce. I'm fortunate in the fact that my wife, who is an actual rocket scientist, makes a good living for us. So I don't have to go to a job. I've made some good choices in life. I've made some fortuitous investments, so I can, I have a luxury that a lot of people don't have. So I'm sort of right at the end of my second semester back in school, and I don't know how people do it who have to work and go to school full time. Mm-hmm. I'm carrying I'm carrying 12 credits, and I wonder where the time for all my homework is going to come from. And and I don't have a job to go to. I don't have children to take care of. I don't have all these things dragging on my time out of necessity. And I have huge respect for these kids who are putting themselves through school, by working a job they probably don't want to be working at. They'd rather be studying, but they gotta pay the tuition. They gotta pay the bills. Mm-hmm. So I am free to sort of explore my passions. As a matter of fact, when I retired from the Air Force in 2004, my wife asked me, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, this company is going to pay me a lot of money." She's like, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Money." And she said, "No, what do you really want to do?" And I said, "I want to write books and play games." And she said, then that's what you're going to do.
Wow.
So I was really good at the playing games part. I was less good at the writing books part. So eventually, thanks to the post 9/11 GI Bill, I basically have a full ride to undergraduate work. So, a year or so ago, 2 years ago maybe, I started investigating the GI Bill, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop half-assed writing, and I'm going to go learn the craft of creative writing. Because, the media presents writing like it's some kind of sorcery, like, you know, you just have ideas and hammer them out on an old Smith Corona typewriter, and voila, there's a novel. And that's not the way it works. The writing is like any other craft. It's no different from carpentry. You have to learn how to use the tools first. You know, you have to learn how to swing a hammer before you can build a house. Mm-hmm. And writing is exactly the same thing. You know, people say, well, you know, Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road in 3 weeks, and he did, but he didn't sell it for 6 years because it needed constant revision. Mm-hmm. You know, it needed six more years worth of work before it was worth trying to sell to anybody. So I really wanted to go back and learn the craft of writing, and it's not easy. I don't think you need any mystical talent to do it. You need a creative streak, but it's also, I think it's one of those small part inspiration, large part perspiration kind of deals.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly sounds like you're living the dream right now, Sheldon. You're able to do the things you love, and it actually sounds like you've lived several dreams based on your life so far.
I have been very fortunate, and you better believe that I'm very appreciative that I am living the dream. I realize that I'm very, very lucky to be able to sort of live the life that some other people aspire to, but I think that also gives me a kind of responsibility not to abuse it. It would be very easy for me to just go into a hole and play video games all day and just sort of serve myself. And I want to share the tremendous gifts that I've been given in life with everybody else. I want to write for Star City not to sort of create my own legend, but because I love magic and I want to share my love of magic with people. You know, I love Commander and I want to share my love of Commander with people. I write the Food and Wine blog because I want to share my love of food and wine with people. I run my RPG because, you know, gamers love great games, and I've been doing it for a long time and have figured out some of the do's and don'ts of running a great game at home, and, you know, I just want to share that with as many people as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly appreciate you sharing your life and your dreams with me tonight, Sheldon.
I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. So if anybody's enjoyed your appearance on my show, Sheldon, how can they get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
You may find me on Twitter, cryptically named Sheldon Menery. You may find me on Facebook, also cryptically named Sheldon Menery. You can find me at Star City Games. You can find me, the food blog is called discoveriesinfoodandwine.com. And feel free to also shoot me an email anytime you want. My also cryptic email is sheldon.menery@gmail.
See, I was hoping there'd be a twist there. Like, I was thinking you were leading up to the Sheldon Menery Twitter, the Sheldon Menery Facebook, and then there was going to be some humdinger of an email.
Like, you know, Rod Johnson 99 for the lols. Yeah.
That would have been awesome, but I'm very happy with what you told me anyways. So, once again, Sheldon, this was a huge thrill for me to have you on the show, and thank you so much for letting me into your world a little bit and for giving me and my listeners a chance to get to know you.
Thanks for having me on, Aaron. I'll be happy to come back sometime soon.
I would love that. And if anyone has enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is also available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can reach the show and follow the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. I am on Twitter at OriginalEstrus. And you can also email me personally at Estrus@ElitistJerks.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay?